Welcome to the Shortwave Report for December 4th, 2015. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK World Radio Japan, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, and Sputnik Radio from Russia. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The German government has decided to send troops and war equipment to join in the war in Syria. The British Parliament voted to join in airstrikes in Syria, and the bombing raids have begun. A prominent Kurdish lawyer and activist was publicly assassinated in Turkey, greatly increasing tensions between Kurds and Turks. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Germany's government has decided to send troops, a warship, and airships to help in the fight against the Islamic State militants in Syria. The approved mandate is expected to last 1 year, as is normally the case with the German involvement in foreign conflicts. However, the decision has been met with opposition.
Bill Clinton said in Bosnia that it would take 1 year, but troops from the West were deployed there for 15 years. I think that in this case, too, one should expect it to go on for longer.
The decision was approved by Germany's cabinet, but must still be approved by Parliament. Talks are due December 2nd. If approved, it would be Germany's biggest military mission since Afghanistan. And the move comes after a request from France to join in the coalition after the deadly Paris attacks on November 13, in which 130 people were killed. The British Parliament have voted in favor of launching airstrikes against the so-called Islamic State militants in Syria. The movement was voted in favor after 10 hours of debate on Wednesday, with Prime Minister David Cameron asserting that the bombing against the so-called medieval monsters in Syria would make Britain safer. We go to DW's Birgit Maas for more.
As David Cameron would have not asked for this vote had he not been sure that he would get his will. He had gauged opinion in the opposition very carefully. The Paris attacks have really influenced the opinions of lawmakers as well as of the public. And many times in this debate I've heard that this could have been London, Paris could have been London, and that it's almost a duty to stand by the Allies. So David Cameron had a sense that he would win this vote.
Within hours of the measure passing, the UK's Ministry of Defence confirmed that the first airstrikes had been carried out.
A prominent Kurdish lawyer and rights activist, Tahir Elçi, was shot in the head and killed on Saturday in the southeastern Turkish city of Diyarbakir. The incident is likely to fuel further unrest in Turkey's mostly Kurdish southeast. For more on how Elçi's death will affect the relations between the Turkish government and the Kurdish minority, we go to Deutsche Welle's Julia Hahn in Istanbul.
I'm afraid it will have a detrimental effect. The pro-Kurdish opposition is accusing the government of President Erdogan or forces loyal to him, while Erdogan said the incident shows Turkey is right in its determined stance in fighting terrorism, referring to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. I spoke to some Kurdish people here in Istanbul earlier, and they said they are shocked and sad and afraid that the conflict between the PKK and the Turkish state will now escalate even further.
The pro-Kurdish HDP party has called the killing of Tahir Elçi a planned assassination and urged people to protest. Elçi was facing trial for saying the banned Kurdistan Workers' Party was not a terrorist organization, as the government describes it. Hours after Elçi's death, police fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse hundreds of people marching in Istanbul to protest against the killing.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. onto NHK World Radio Japan. A Japanese ship is traveling the Pacific and Antarctic oceans to survey microplastics. Other Japanese ships have headed to the Antarctic to harvest whales, despite protest from Australia, New Zealand, and Sea Shepherd activists. NHK Japan.
A Japanese ship has set sail for the Pacific and Antarctic oceans to survey microplastics, which are small particles harmful to marine life. Researchers from Kyushu University, the Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology, and other institutions departed Tokyo on Monday. They plan to survey Pacific waters off East Asia and around Oceania and the Antarctic Ocean. The study is scheduled to run through next March. Previous studies have found heavy microplastics in waters far from human habitation in parts of the Pacific Ocean, as well as in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. Experts say the Japanese survey could shed light on how such pollution has been spreading on a global scale. Microplastics are fine plastic particles that are less than 5 millimeters in diameter. The plastics are known to attract and hold toxic substances to their surfaces. Experts say they can be ingested by marine organisms, causing damage to the marine ecosystem.
Japanese vessels have left the port in western Japan on an expedition to the Antarctic Ocean under a revised government research whaling program. The new plan calls for taking only minke whales and reducing the catch to 333, one-third the previous number. Japan argues that the population of these species is relatively large and aims to commercialize minke whaling in the future. The government announced the plan last month after the International Court of Justice in March 2014 ordered Japan to halt its whaling activities. The Yushinmaru and Yushinmaru No. 2 left the port in Shimonoseki City, Yamaguchi Prefecture, on Tuesday. They are expected to conduct their activities in the Antarctic Ocean from late December to early March. Intense protests are expected from anti-whaling groups, as this will be the first time whales have been caught by Japan since the International Court ruling.
Japan's fisheries minister says his country's whaling practices are based on international law. He stresses that they are indispensable for collecting scientific data with the aim of managing maritime resources. Hiroshi Moriyama was referring to Japan's decision to resume research whaling in the Antarctic Ocean. The minister said the operation will contribute to Japan's aim of resuming commercial whaling in the future. Australia and New Zealand have issued statements criticizing Japan for its renewed whaling program. Anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd has warned Japan of further attempts to obstruct whaling operations. Moriyama said illegal obstruction of whaling operations was extremely regrettable and stressed the government's determination to ensure that those working on Japanese vessels remain safe.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has dismissed Russia's claim it has proof Turkey has been involved in oil trades with Islamic State militants. Turkey shot down a Russian bomber near the border with Syria on November 24th. The downing raised tension between the two countries. In a briefing in Moscow on Wednesday, Russian officials disclosed satellite images of tanker trucks and petroleum facilities. They cited satellite images they said show oil tanker trucks traveling on three routes from the militant group's territories in Syria and Iraq to Turkey. They said the vehicles go to a harbor on the Turkish Mediterranean Sea, a refinery in the southeastern city of Batman, and a transshipment station in a southeastern city of Zisley. They also said that Erdogan and his family have been involved in trading oil. Russian officials asserted that Turkey is a supply source of terrorists. They said nearly 2,000 fighters and 120 tons of ammunition were smuggled into territories held by the militant group last week.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 to 10:30 p.m. at 11740 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Spanish National Radio. A report on the political and social climate in Lebanon, where a terrorist attack occurred the day before the Paris attacks. then a report on global protest before the start of the United Nations Climate Summit in Paris. Spanish National Radio.
Lebanon, politically fractured among its several groups, which include the pro-Syrian Hezbollah, the Saudi-backed Sunni leader Saad al-Hariri, and the Maronite Christians, has been without a president for 18 months. Movements are being made towards forming a power-sharing government headed by a family friend of Syria's Bashar al-Assad, with al-Hariri in the post of prime minister. But it remains to be seen if the deal satisfies the country's diverse and divisive political forces. Bordering on Syria, Lebanon has long suffered the effects of the neighboring conflict, with numerous attacks, mostly by Daesh and al-Qaeda affiliate al-Nusra on its soil. Just one day before the November 13 Paris attacks, Beirut suffered a very similar attack in which 43 people were killed when two suicide bombers struck a bustling Beirut neighborhood. The world hardly responded. But when, just a day later, the world was waving the French flag and speaking of shared values, these values, it seemed, were reserved for the victims in Paris. The victims in Lebanon and other parts were ignored. After the attacks in Paris, Facebook offered users a one-click option to overlay their profile pictures with the French three-colored flag, a service not offered for the Lebanese flag. That Friday, the social media giant also activated its safety check, a feature usually reserved for natural disasters that lets people alert loved ones when they are unhurt. They had not activated it the day before for Beirut. Tiny Lebanon has also taken in more than 1.1 million Syrian refugees, making one in every five residents of Lebanon a refugee in this country of 4.5 million inhabitants. The impact is staggering. Trash has remained uncollected in the streets for months. Rents have skyrocketed because of the increased housing demand for those fleeing Syria, sapping the refugees' life savings and pricing out the nearly 1 million Lebanese living below the poverty line even before the crisis. Lebanon's economy has also taken a hit, according to the United Nations Development Programme. Tourism dropping 23% and exports to Syria falling 7.5% since Syria's civil war erupted in 2011. Leaders and representatives of 195 countries are meeting in Paris for yet another summit on climate change, although this time they hope to reach the first global accord. The Kyoto summit of 1997 expires, but since the accords that time did not include the major global producers of CO2 responsible for human-produced global warming, the United States and China, the Paris summit faces a do-or-die ultimatum. Along with the some 40,000 delegates and 3,000 journalists in Paris for the summit, environmentalists and other activists have gathered as well. Though the state of emergency declared by the French government after the November 13 attacks, in which 130 people were killed, prohibits any protest marches. On Sunday, 10,000 demonstrators, according to the organizers, under half that according to the police, formed a double human chain between Paris's Place de la République and the Place de la Nation, covering a 3-kilometer area originally proposed for the march that had been banned. Before the protest, the French government had placed 24 environmental activists under preventative house arrest. The demonstration began peacefully, but ended with violent clashes between a couple of hundred protesters and riot police that sprayed tear gas to dissolve the group. 289 protesters, emboldened by the restrictions against demonstrations and chanting Liberté, freedom, were arrested. Others place shoes, more than 22,000 pairs of shoes, in the plaza as a silent demonstration calling on world leaders to reach an accord. Pope Francis and UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon were among those represented in that silent demand. Demonstrations have also been held in London, New York, Athens, Madrid, Rio de Janeiro, and elsewhere. Some 50,000 people marched in London, where Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed the crowd. The mayor of Sydney, Australia, tweeted that with 45,000 people demonstrating, it was the largest march ever seen in that city. And in Madrid, a demonstrator told Reuters,
"We are here to defend our planet, to fight for a better place for our children to live in the future. We have caused too much damage to our planet in the last 30 years, and I really don't know if we are going to be able to recover it."
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio. Spain is no longer broadcasting on shortwave, but they may be heard irregularly at their website, www.rtve.es/radio/radio-exterior. On to Radio Havana, Cuba. More details about climate protest held in 2,400 places around the world before the start of the Paris summit. Then summaries of what Ecuador's President Correa and Bolivia's President Evo Morales said at the opening of the climate summit. Radio Havana, Cuba.
More than 500,000 people took part in rallies around the world ahead of today's opening of the 21st United Nations Climate Change Summit. More than 2,400 events around the world took place this weekend, with demonstrators calling for a major shift in climate change policies. World leaders began arriving in Paris over the weekend for the summit that will continue for 2 weeks of negotiations aimed at reaching an accord on global warming. In London, tens of thousands of protesters gathered to call for change. Protesters blame Western leaders for failing to do enough to tackle the crucial issue affecting the world today. Demonstrators gathered in Asia, Africa, and Latin America to call on their local representatives to push for a bold international agreement at the summit in Paris.
Speaking at the COP21 climate summit in Paris on Monday, Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa argued that unlimited economic growth is an undesirable and impossible, explaining that consumption is dominating efficiency. He said that greed is becoming our worst nightmare and that the key question wasn't of economic growth, but of what and who was growing. Someone in a rich country emits 38 times more CO2 than someone from a poor country, he said, adding that there was a planetary emergency that demanded worldwide treatment and an ecological debt that should be paid. Conservation in poor countries isn't possible if quality of life there isn't improved, he stated. Concretely, Correa called for a universal declaration of the rights of nature, something that Ecuador has already recognized, and for the creation of an international court of environmental justice. The court, he said, would punish environmental crimes and oblige the payment of environmental debts.
Bolivian President Evo Morales was scheduled to meet with social movement leaders on Tuesday upon his return from the COP21 climate summit in Paris. Evo Morales has a history of bringing social movements to the forefront of discussions on the impacts of climate change and giving grassroots activists a voice in shaping the development of future policies. In his address at COP21 on Monday, Morales said he went to Paris armed with the proposals of social movements developed at the People's Climate Summit held in Cochabamba, Bolivia in October. Morales also slammed capitalism for being the biggest threat to the climate and called for a transformation of savage and destructive practices to save Mother Earth, based on an action plan drafted by social movements. Morales stressed the urgency for international action, saying that complicit silence of world leaders must end to face the crisis of being on the brink of humanity's destruction after capitalism turned everything into a commodity over the course of two centuries.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 11760 and from 4 p.m. to 11 at either 6165, 6125, or 6000, and streaming on the web from 4 p.m. to 11 at www.radiohc.cu. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Listener support is essential for the Shortwave Report to continue. Please help if you can. We will conclude with Sputnik Radio. Afshin Ratansi interviewed Nick Dearden, director of the NGO Global Justice Now. They talked about the corporate influence on the Paris Climate Summit, the relationship of austerity measures to climate degradation, and the banning of protest in Paris during these crucial talks. Sputnik Radio.
What have the Paris climate change talks sponsored by big multinationals achieved so far, apart from hundreds of arrests of activists and plumes of tear gas rising from the Place de la République? With me is Nick Dearden, National Director of NGO Global Justice Now. Welcome back, Nick. So how corrupt is the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change?
Well, it's supposed to be a UN process, so you'd think it was reasonably unbiased. Actually, if you look at who's sponsoring it, it's some of the worst climate criminals on the planet. So you've got Air France, you've got Renault, the car company, you've got energy companies like EDF, you've got banks like BNP Paribas, which are investing in coal, you've got pro-fracking groups. I mean, they're all there sponsoring this summit, which is supposed to be about reducing our impact on the climate, about halting climate change. And they're right there in the center of this conference. Now, as I say, in some ways, that's just a symptom. But all around the convention, they will be having very lavish receptions and events to try to persuade governments that if you just leave things to them, you know, the market will sort out climate change.
And I understand there's been a leaked memo already.
One of the newspapers has seen a leak from the United States which sets out what the United States wants to get out of the next 2 weeks in Paris. And one of the big things is it does not want to sign a binding treaty. So at the same time as Obama is pushing forward with all these free trade agreements, which he wants to be very binding because they free up corporations to make profit, often from exploiting the environment, he's saying there must be no binding regulation that will come out of COP. It's for each individual country to voluntarily regulate itself. And he's also saying, actually, what we want to do is ensure that we are carbon neutral at the end of the day. Well, carbon neutral sounds kind of nice, but what does it actually mean? It actually means it's okay for rich countries to go on polluting as much as they want, as long as they pay so that other countries that aren't able to develop in the same way, because we're so constrained in terms of our environmental limits, they just have to accept our trash, basically. They have to be used to soak up all this pollution. They're all saying the right, I mean, you know, wonderful speeches about how important climate change is, but then look at what their solution to climate change is. And their solutions are actually, you know, put big business, put the market into the driving seat, as if it wasn't already in the driving seat. I mean, as if the lack of regulation, the leave the market to its own devices, the let big business decide on its own regulations, that's what's fueled the climate catastrophe. I mean, that's what's led to just absolutely out of control emissions, and governments have to stand back and they're not allowed to plan. Yet this is their solution again to the problem that this has created.
Do you think that the reason that the media isn't talking so much about this corruption, the liaisons between big businesses and governments, is because it's spending more time on asking the question, is climate change even true or not?
Right, exactly. I mean, what a distraction this is from the real debate. So a tiny handful of people, many of whom are funded by big business, are still arguing this isn't even happening. I mean, you know, the vast, vast, vast majority of the world is completely agreed, including all scientists, completely agreed that this is happening. And yet we're still insisting on having this debate. What we should be arguing about is what we do to halt climate change. And the kinds of solutions that you're going to hear a lot about over the next week, probably quite uncritically, are things like climate smart agriculture, right, which is agribusiness, one of the biggest polluters in the world. I mean, nearly as bad as the fossil fuel companies, promoting themselves as the solution. More technology, more genetic modification, more fertilizers and chemicals. We'll be able to grow all the food we want. And somehow, miraculously, this will also save the climate. It won't. Look at the idea of markets in environmental goods. So you've got, like, carbon markets were created quite a while ago, been a complete disaster. Let's try and trade and reduce carbon. I mean, it sounds like it might work, but it's been a disaster. Actually, what it's done is subsidize some of the worst fossil fuel users in the world. And now they're talking about new markets and things like biodiversity. So essentially, you know, you can go on polluting this bit of the world, you can go on trashing the environment here, and then you pay something so it gets offset somewhere else. Politicians and big business are completely in bed with one another and have been for a long time. And that's not only the cause or a significant cause of climate change, but a significant cause of inequality, a significant cause of why our democracy is being stripped away from us. You know, the thing about climate change is all the things we need to do to redress climate change are the things we also need to do to make the world a fairer place, to reduce inequality and so on. You know, to reduce the power of big business, to take things out of the market and provide them in a different way, to support, you know, small farmers being able to make a living, to take back control of energy supplies like they've done or are trying to do in Germany, to democratically control energy supplies so you can invest more in renewable, because if it's a little bit more expensive, we're prepared to pay that cost rather than cutting everything down to the bare minimum. To fight austerity. I mean, some people think, well, if you've got to fight climate change, you've got to kind of go on a high austerity diet. But actually, austerity as it's being applied in Europe now is absolutely antithetical to trying to halt climate change, because what you're doing is continuing to allow the very rich to live completely unsustainable lives while cutting back on things like public transport or well-insulated housing, you know, which you absolutely need to fight climate change. So we need the opposite. You look at all these world leaders trotting off to Paris saying we're going to do this brilliant deal, and at the same time they're the very same people who are signing us up to all these free trade deals which will hand huge amounts of new power to fossil fuel companies, amongst others. I mean, there was a report just last week that the European Commission was working with big oil companies like ExxonMobil to help it write the energy chapter of TTIP, the US-EU free trade deal. So oil companies are helping the European Commission write the energy chapter. How on earth are we going to have something in TTIP which can in any way help climate change?
You called it an irony that the French security clampdown, France, of course, under a state of emergency, and the climate change protesters not being able to demonstrate.
Well, I think it throws the whole question of the legitimacy of the climate talks into question, really, because the ability of people to come and hold their leaders to account at these kind of events is crucial to whether we see these things as legitimate or not. And while all the business events will continue going ahead, all the lobbying and so on around the edges will continue going ahead, the big sponsorship deals and so on, not to mention the Christmas markets, the football matches and so on, the people who've come to try to halt climate change by holding their leaders to account are told, you cannot meet and protest. It's a really very serious step. And, you know, I think if the French government really thought that it couldn't allow protests to go ahead, then it should have said we are unable to hold this UN process. Because without it, it really does lack legitimacy.
Nick Dearden, thank you.
Thank you.
That interview is from Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at sputniknews.com. All the times I've mentioned are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is even easier. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, now in its 19th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.